Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hello, Negotiations Ninja listeners. You've got Mark here. Today, my guest is the amazing Rafael Lapin. We get into a conversation about what makes for a good mediation. What are all the ingredients that you need within the recipe that makes for a great mediation? And there is a difference between a great mediation and a average mediation. We get into the weeds on this discussion with this fascinating conversation with Rafael Lapin. Hello, Rafael. How are you?
Well, thank you, Mark. And thank you so much for having me back to your podcast. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to be stimulated by your insightful questions. I'm looking forward to our brief interaction this morning.
I am very excited myself. And thank you for your grace. This is take two. For the listeners, just so that you know, we've been having some internet connectivity issues in the office where we record these. And I had to call Rafael back in a panic, saying, hey, something happened to the audio. It's not working. So thankfully, he was gracious enough to be able to reschedule some time with us. And we're here today to talk all about mediation. But before we get into the conversation, Rafael, maybe tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, first of all, about the panic, I think I had more panic than you because I thought I was expected to remember the last podcast verbatim and have to repeat everything. And I was really talking off the cuff as I plan to do today as well. So I was relieved to hear that I don't have to necessarily repeat word for word as we said the first time round. But at any rate, I'll just regard that as practice. A bit more about what I do. So Mark, as you're fully aware, I'm a negotiation and dispute resolution specialist. So really anything negotiation related or dispute resolution related falls under my purview. And that involves government entities, corporate entities, and individuals who might be in a lawsuit or whatever. We sort of work with all those and anything related to that. So sometimes in a negotiation, we will provide negotiation advice and support in complex negotiations. And sometimes we'll be actually asked to represent or at least be at the table. In dispute resolution sometimes as well. The best and cheapest way to resolve a dispute is through direct negotiation. But 95% of those negotiations fail, largely because of usually when there is a dispute already, there's a lot of emotion packed up in there, particularly if a lawsuit has already been filed. There's resentment, there's anger, there's anxiousness, and all those obstructions to a productive and constructive negotiation. So 95% of direct negotiations fail. If direct negotiations fail and you still want to avoid a lawsuit, there are some other options. One option is to retain a dispute resolution specialist who will, again, provide strategy for you, direct you, coach you in how to resolve that dispute, and be there for support as you're trying to get beyond the dispute. And of course, if that fails, you always have the option of mediation where the two parties will together retain the services of a neutral mediator who will help the parties actually engage in productive and constructive dialogue and seek creative joint solutions to conflicting needs. So those all are related. Of course, dispute resolution and negotiation are closely related because in any form of dispute resolution, whether it's direct dispute resolution with through services of a mediator, you are using negotiation techniques, skills, and processes. So you're using the same framework, whether it's dispute or transactional. So those are the sort of things we're doing all the time and sort of providing our clients with those sort of services. Now, sometimes, for example, yesterday, we just got a call from a larger company who more of a not as common a request, but basically building a capacity within their organization and having a whole department that manages negotiations. Basically teaching them how to train their people and working myself out of a job. But that's okay as well. I don't have a problem with that either. I think because
just gotta make sure the price is right for you.
Well, that's right. And to make sure there is a provision that they can't use our material outside their company, obviously. For me, there are two aspects of the work that I do. Obviously, for me, it's a living and how I earn my living. But equally important, probably for me, is that it's an area of great satisfaction. And I'm very fortunate in that the work that I do for my living and the work that I do that I feel is my purpose in making a contribution to society intersects over the areas of negotiation or dispute resolution. And that's something I think that is unfortunate in regard to that.
I do love everything that you're doing online, by the way. And I will say that for the listeners, if you're listening in right now, Rafael writes a fantastic newsletter/article that gets released. I think it's monthly, is it?
Well, that's a good question. So lately during COVID, I've kind of tracked it a little bit on that, but I'm doing a different strategy now, which you might find interesting. So I'm not putting them out as commonly, but the stuff that I am putting out now, I'm getting published by third parties. So magazines or newspapers, whatever, sort of publishing those articles. So that takes a lot longer. I'm right now in the middle of quite a fascinating 2,000-word article about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that I hope to get published. One of my articles on what Biden's approach would be with China and Russia was published in Foreign Affairs. And then on the Ethiopian dam, of course, and you probably saw because I was on Al Jazeera for that. That was published through, I think, 4 or 5 publications across the continent of Africa. So my thinking about that is anybody can publish their own stuff nowadays. And there's no discernment as to what's put out there. And it's really up to the consumer who may be or may not be educated in terms of discernment, you know, to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff. So my approach and strategy has now been put out stuff that's published by third parties. If it's good enough for them, then it's good enough for me and it's good enough to put out to the public. So that has been my approach. But you're absolutely right. On my website, Mark, there is 2 or 3 years, probably a couple of hundred articles on negotiation-related topics, all very practical, all providing the information you can use.
And it's, I like the depth archived of research that you go into on this.
Yeah. And I do try to learn. A lot of my articles do relate to international affairs because I see that as a kind of the apex of negotiation, because there's complexity, there's deep needs and concerns and emotional issues that are there. So I learn a lot from researching international conflicts, and I apply a lot of that to much smaller conflicts, but a lot of that same research I do apply. So that's true.
Before we get into the weeds on mediation, I'd love for you to delineate the differences between arbitration and mediation, because I think a lot of people get those two things confused.
That's really an important point. And I think you're right. Lay people do get those two points confused. Now, I do remember we spoke a little bit about this in round one, and I spoke about what I use as a continuum, and I call it the dispute resolution continuum. And if you go all the way to the left-hand side of that continuum, you start off with negotiation. As I mentioned earlier, direct negotiation. You and I are either doing a deal or we have a dispute. And I'll say to you, look, Mark, we have a dispute over here. I don't think it behooves either of us to try to take this to court if we can resolve it to our satisfaction without that. Let's at least sit down and talk about it and explore what some of your concerns and needs are. I'll share some of mine and see if you might be able to come up with some resolution. So that's negotiation. As you move along from left to right along that dispute resolution continuum, then come to, if negotiation fails, we can do mediation, as I said earlier. Mediation really, to put it into very simple terms, is facilitated negotiation, where the mediator is a specialist and an expert on the process of negotiation and effective communication, and he facilitates that communication and negotiation between the parties in a way that it remains productive and purposeful and helps the parties to reach resolution. What's important to point out in mediation is the mediator has no decision-making power. So the mediator can't say, this is what I'm ruling or this is what I'm saying you have to do. There is none of that at all. The mediator has no decision-making power. He is a process facilitator, and he helps the parties reach agreement. If parties do not reach agreement, or if one party doesn't want to agree, there's no agreement. And that's all there is to it. Having said that, statistics typically show that between 85 and 95% of cases settle. Even litigated cases usually settle on the steps of the courthouse. It's only about 5% of cases that actually reach trial. What we're trying to do is to bring that forward. Why spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of litigation where we can just bring that whole line forward and settle it now before it gets to that stage? So that's what mediation is. And mediation is quite broadly used in court districts across the US, and I'm pretty sure Canada from what I've read as well, and across the world. It's becoming quite a popular form of resolution, particularly given COVID now, where there's so much backlog on the courthouse dockets. Many judges will recommend or even order mediation before they're actually further in the process. Not uncommon at all. So that's mediation, and I call that, well, that's called is facilitative mediation. As we move further along the continuum, we get to what's called evaluative mediation. It's also mediation, but it's closer to arbitration in the sense that usually the people who practice facilitative mediation are usually lawyers that have been in litigation for many years or retired judges who are always in the courtroom mindset. And evaluative mediation typically is the mediator will put subtle pressure on the parties using the law as leverage. And they'll say, they'll meet the party separately and they'll say, look, if you went to court in this is what I, having done many of these cases, this is probably the outcome you would get. So I would urge you to settle on that basis because otherwise it may be a lot worse for you. And they go to the other party and do something similar. So they are trying to sort of subtly strong arm the parties into agreement based on their experience of litigation. So it's not yet quite ordering them to do it, but it's very strong pressure that they're asserting upon the parties to agree. So that's evaluative mediation. much closer in the continuum to arbitration. Moving further to the right is arbitration. And arbitration is distinct from mediation in that mediation is a facilitative process based on negotiation, where arbitration is an adjudicative process where the arbitrator is basically a judge for hire. Usually he's an expert on the subject matter of the case. For example, if it's a construction dispute, he will have had experience in litigating construction cases and be quite familiar with construction law. He will hear the parties' cases. Sometimes there'll be discovery, sometimes it won't. There may be evidence presented in the way of witnesses, maybe not. I mean, they can design how they want that to be, as opposed to a court case, which is based on civil procedure. So the nice thing about arbitration is you can decide and design how extensive you want that the formality of the arbitration to be. But at the end of the day, you have no choice in arbitration. The arbitrator is going to make the decision for you. It's typically binding, where before you go into that arbitration, you sign an arbitration agreement, which binds you to anything the arbitrator says. So that's basically an adjudicated process like a court. But the difference is it's less formal. You can do it quicker. You can design how formal you want the process to be, how much discovery you want the process to involve, and so on and so forth. And that's the arbitration component of it. Arbitration is very difficult to appeal. It's almost impossible to appeal. That's part of the arbitration process. There are only two cases in which you can appeal it, and that is where it's clear that the arbitrator made a gross error in terms of law, or whether there's an unconscionable decision. Both difficult things to prove, and it's almost impossible, I would say, to appeal an arbitration. And then finally, moving further to the right, you've got litigation. And of course, litigation is, we all know what litigation is all too well, unfortunately. And that's, of course, the most extreme. So as you move from the left to the right, the process has become more invasive and more expensive and costly as you go from negotiation and more adversarial. So moving from that left to right continuum, as you're moving, you get into more adversity and you get more expensive and costly, and it takes more time. At the end of the day, I think it's important for parties to decide, knowing that continuum, which makes more sense. Once you go straight to litigation, it's difficult to de-escalate. If you start on the left-hand side of the continuum, you can always escalate. So parties need to think about that very carefully and kind of remove the emotional side of the dispute when they're trying to make a decision. What process would be best to try to resolve this?
I find it interesting that so many people don't think about that continuum and they default to litigation.
Yes.
As the way that you would resolve a dispute. I was chatting with an organization some time ago and we were working on a case together, and they defaulted straight to litigation. I was like, guys, before you go down this road, I really want you to consult some very good legal counsel, because going down this road is going to lead to a significant cost outlay. And it may not necessarily be worth it, or worth your time, or worth the headaches, or worth the press.
And unpredictable.
And very unpredictable. Yeah. Right, you can try and forecast it as best you can, but you don't know for
always
sure.
Unpredictable.
Unless you have a slam dunk case, even then it may not necessarily be worth it. So
yes.
I like your advice around starting off on the left-hand side and then escalating from there, because you may be able to resolve it before you get to a litigation procedure. And what I will say for the listeners, just so that you know, we're going to preface this and we're going to make sure that we do it in the intro. None of this is legal advice. You should still seek the counsel of a qualified attorney at all times with any kind of legal stuff that you're going into. Obviously, this is meant purely for informational purposes, so please don't use this as legal advice. Please go and seek the counsel of a qualified attorney that can help you along the way. That being said, let's get into the weeds. When it comes to mediation, I find this to be very interesting, and facilitated negotiation, I should say, maybe more broadly, because you get brought into situations where you may have two parties that don't want to go to the litigation route. They want to try and resolve it. They recognize the cost or the expense or the unpredictable nature of litigation. They want to try and resolve it before they get there. And you get brought into situations where you are maybe a neutral third party trying to facilitate a conversation between two other parties who disagree on something that want to get something done. As a mediator, as someone who deals with this kind of stuff all the time, what is the process that you think about when going into those kinds of situations to try and make it as productive as possible?
I try to get my mindset to a place, Mark. I understand that both parties, from the way they're seeing things, make sense to them. It may not make sense to me, it may not make sense to you, but it makes sense to them, based on their needs, based on their concerns, based on their fears, based on how the filters through which they've processed some of the information. And I say this many times, where somebody will come to speak to me, or I'll hear the one side and I'll say, you know, it makes so much sense. I can't see where the other side is coming from. And then I'll speak to the other side and boom, there's some information that suddenly opens it up and things are making sense from their side too. And what typically happens in any kind of a dispute or any kind of argument or debate that we might be engaged in, I see things very dogmatically from my side and you see things very dogmatically from your side. I remain in my space and you remain in your space and there's never any exchange of for me to make sure that I get a sense of how you're seeing it and vice versa. So, and I think part of that emerges from the fact that people confuse understanding with agreeing. I think people think that if I really make an effort of understanding you and I explain to you, I say, Mark, let me see, make sure that I understand you 100% here. And I then go on to argue your case more compellingly than you can argue it yourself, that people think, well, that means I must agree with you. No, it doesn't. It means that I've understood you. It doesn't mean that I've agreed with you. And people have to, in their own mind, be able to separate understanding with agreeing. So what I try to sort of make that very much part of the mediation, that I facilitate understanding, I make it very clear. All I'm asking you to do is to try to understand, putting yourself in the other party's shoes, how they see it. Because if you're going to change their mind, you have to know where their mind is at and what it's like to be in their mind. So the first thing is really to understand how are they seeing it. To the extent that you can actually bring yourself to the point, you know, that makes sense. If I was them, that makes a lot of sense to me. I can see how they might be seeing it that way. So facilitating that understanding and making sure that parties realize they can understand perfectly well without necessarily agreeing. I always like to refer the story of my mentor, Roger Fish, in Harvard. I think you went to that program in Harvard.
I did.
Probably when you and Roger had already passed away. Roger wrote the Getting to Yes book, and he was a fascinating individual in many regards, and we were still very fortunate enough to still get his tutorage. But he used to argue cases in front of the Supreme Court, and the way he would argue his cases was he would start off by arguing his opponent's case, and he would argue it more eloquently and more articulately than his opponent argued it himself. And the judge would become confused, and the judge would say, Mr. Fisher, whose side are you on? And Roger would say, you know, bear with me, Your Honor, I'm getting there. And after having a demonstrated immaculate understanding of the other side, he would then say, and Your Honor, there is a different way of looking at this as well, and then start presenting his case, a very compelling debating technique. And I think in negotiation, that's also equally important, where I spend much more time really trying to understand you and then trying to assert my own demands.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. Something that you said piqued my interest there, and I think we've all been guilty of this. You said something to the effect of people being dogmatic about what they believe in. And sometimes I find that when people are negotiating, there's almost like a religious adherence to the position that they have. Is there a way that you help them to, I don't want to say overcome that adherence to their position, because that's important, but maybe to try and understand more of the interests of the other party? Is how do you take them through that process?
Well, yes. What you really want to do is they come in, we could exchange the word dogmatic for rigid. And I think they're both true. I think they're dogmatic about the positions, but they're also very rigid about the positions. They'd really dug in. Think about a big oak tree with its roots firmly planted into the ground. That's kind of where the position is at when they come in. So you need to be able to loosen the earth around the positions and to make it much less rigid in terms of being able to then allow them to think a little bit more broadly. And as you know, one of the keystones of interest-based negotiation, which we're both very familiar with, and I feel almost inadequate in presenting this because it's so, I mean, any negotiation material you look at today speaks about interests. Not everybody has a depth of understanding of it, but it's become overused and it's become, you know, everybody's rebranding it in some way or another. And I think we spoke about last time in terms of the fact there's a lot more in negotiation technique and skill and processes than interests and positions. But in terms of loosening the earth around those positions, it's important to work through the party's position in trying to get below the position, because a position really is a solution. So for example, if I say to you, we want $100,000 for that. Well, that's one solution. But what are you really looking for? You're looking for fair compensation. And the other way is you can provide fair compensation than just $100,000. Okay, I may be able to offer you work in the future. We're doing another project in place X, Y, or Z. We do have an opening there. Is that something that might interest you as part of the compensation package? But as long as we're stuck on $100,000, which is a position, that's one possible solution. It's not the only solution. So a position, when they present a position, they're usually presenting the solution. We have to understand what the problem is to which they're presenting the solution. So in that example that I gave you, the solution is $100,000, but the problem really is how do we reach fair compensation? And I will reframe it. I will use the reframing technique a lot. And I'll say, so what you really look, when they come in and say $100,000, I'm not going to use my active listening to reinforce the position. I'll never use active listening to reinforce something that's not useful. So I will use my active listening to reframe that into something more useful, a less rigid position, and something that helps us define the problem. And I say, so what you're really looking for over here is fair compensation. Is that correct? Have I understood you correctly? Yes, absolutely. Well, fair compensation, what have we just done? We just loosened the earth around those deep roots of the big oak tree of, we demand $100,000, and now it becomes fair compensation.
In the process, what you've done is you've also created so many alternatives, right, to what may solve the ultimate problem, which is fair compensation.
And that's where we want to go to. We're just busy in a complex negotiation right now. And, you know, always they try to get you, well, make us an offer. And you don't want to do that because whatever offer you make, you're going to be negotiating against yourself because they're going to flinch and they've got to say, well, you've got to do better than that. So the technique that we use talking about options is we never present one offer. We'll present multiple equivalent simultaneous offers. We could do option A and sort of a list of components to option A, option B, a list of components to option B, and option C. It makes it a lot more difficult for them to flinch because then they start looking unreasonable. What, nothing in these offers appeal to you?
I love that approach. One of the key things that I think a lot of people think about when it comes to mediation is the frustration and tension that may pop up in these sort of long protracted discussions. And I would imagine, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it's very rare to come to a solution in one meeting. I would imagine that there's several discussions that need to be had by both parties. How do you manage the tension that may exist, or do you manage it? Is there a way for you to leverage that in the conversation throughout these long discussions that you have between both parties?
Well, you've got to look at mediation or negotiation for that matter as an evolutionary process. And typically when they come into the mediation in the morning, there's a lot of tension. There's anger almost, you know, there's emotions that one side doesn't want to look at the other side. As the day progresses and as communication takes place and as understanding occurs, as I mentioned earlier, that starts diminishing and decreasing. You can't do that instantly. It's got to evolve during the day. So, of course, you're managing that all the time. And what you want to be careful of is that it doesn't obstruct the productive negotiation. Now, if there are strong emotions over there, you can't tell them, don't get so emotional, calm down. That doesn't work. So you've got to allow them to vent a little bit.
I think in the history of mankind, telling someone to calm down has never caused them to calm down.
It doesn't work. Now, people still do it, despite the fact that it's been ultimately proven that it never, ever works.
Yes.
I'm sure Adam said to Eve, calm down, and that was probably the beginning of his problem.
So managing that tension and managing that frustration as an evolutionary process takes time. And do you preface...
And time and skill and process.
Yes. Do you preface the conversation with both parties to say, hey, as we go into this, there are going to be some situations where you may get frustrated or the other party may get frustrated. You may get tense. The other party may get tense. If and when that happens, do you have like rules that you set at the beginning? Like if you want to call a timeout, you call a timeout. How do you preface that conversation?
So many mediators, and you know, sometimes I will do that. It depends on the situation. But many mediators will start the process with what they call ground rules. You've got to be careful with those ground rules because the last thing you want to do is to come over as an authoritative schoolmaster telling them how to behave. So that becomes part of the negotiations. And I call that, and I'm sure you've heard this term, the talks about the talks. So we may have some discussion, it may be even in pre-mediation conversations we have over the phone and so on. And I'll always have some pre-mediation conversations with attorneys. at a minimum. And we want to have the talks before the talks. Are there any things at all that concern you in terms of how this process might go? And I raise things. We're concerned about in joint sessions, when we've tried to talk, just got so emotional and so angry, just got so angry at each other and just erupted into a swearing match and it's been unproductive. I'll say, okay, how can I help you manage that in a way that it won't derail negotiate? What ideas might you have?
I really like this approach.
So I'm getting their input. So they'll be negotiating the process is what we're doing. And again, that's something I've gotten from international negotiations as well. In big international negotiations, a lot of work is put into the talks about the talks and setting that all up. So I've borrowed that from international negotiations and used that on a much smaller scale in terms of the mediations and negotiations that we do every day.
It strikes me that the need for diplomacy in those types of conversations is so important because you can't come barreling in with your own ideas about how things should run. I love that you start the conversation with asking them about what they foresee as what my challenges
correct,
occur,
correct.
Right? That in and of itself is such good advice for the listeners. I hope you caught that. The whole idea is prior to going into the negotiation itself, you would start what Raphael calls the talks about the talks, which is basically pre-negotiations to say, hey, what do you see as things that may stall this? Where do you think you might get frustrated? What do you see as challenges that we may need to overcome? Where have things gone wrong in the past? Those kinds of sort of broad questions to generate discussion around how you could help them. That is such a key piece of advice. And I think that so many people going into complex negotiations, and I would say that your approach is really good for complex negotiations, going into complex negotiations, miss that out because they're so used to the tactical that comes
correct,
into it,
correct.
Right? They think it's about a price, as per your example earlier, or an amount when it may be much deeper rooted than that. And you have to get to the emotion of it more than anything else.
Yes. And you know, it's also important for management as well, because management are involved in negotiations without even realizing it.
Yes.
So for example, if I come to one of my employees and I say, please have this report done by tomorrow. And they say, I'm terribly sorry, sir. So that can't turn that around by tomorrow. So, you know, one way is to, through authority and command, well, I command you and demand that you do it by tomorrow, otherwise you're fired. And that's not going to get me very far. But if I say to them, I say, you know, getting to those interests, loosening the earth around those roots, that rigid position. And I say, can you explain to me some of the constraints you might have? Because if I understand that, we may be able to find some solution to that. And then they'll say, well, I've got to do this for this person. I've got to do that for that person. And I'll say, do you have any ideas of how I might shift that around? What are the priorities?
So you're asking them for the solution.
So I'm using similar techniques. And management, you know, there's all sorts of theory about good management and so on. But managers, what they don't realize really is that there's so much involved that relates to negotiation and mediation.
Yes, big time. I can imagine that at some point in the mediation process, you've got to start closing towards a final solution, but sometimes corralling both parties to keep their agreements is probably quite challenging. Is there a way that you can get people to commit and keep to their commitments on what has been agreed to throughout so that you can get to a close? How do you manage that?
So that gets to your earlier question, which I think I don't fully address, and that is you asked about getting the mediation resolved in a meeting or not. So, you know, some mediations will get resolved in a meeting. And what we will typically do is make sure that we write some kind of agreement and get that agreement signed in the meeting, even if it's on the back of a napkin. But we will get something signed if agreement is reached. But many times what happens is at the end of the mediation, I realize there is room here for agreement. We haven't gotten to complete agreement just yet, but there is room for agreement. There's definitely room to move over here. And I think I can do something. I will continue working with the parties offline and working towards agreement there. And again, it'll always, and then we've got an email track and I always summarize in the emails as we're sort of building up towards agreement. But at the end of the day, when we have reached agreement, you know, I will always make sure to have something signed. Now, one mistake that I've made in the past, and I don't make it anymore, is that what has happened in the past is the attorneys say, well, yes, thank you. We think we've got it from here. And I think they've got it from there, but they haven't. It falls apart. So I never leave it to the attorneys until we've got something signed. So if they say to me, when they say to me, yes, so, you know, we think we've got it from here. No, they haven't got it from there. They make a mess of it 9 times out of 10. So I need to stay involved until we've got something signed.
You ever had a situation where someone has used the mediation process to escalate the situation and purposefully evade solution to try and drive it towards more of the right-hand side of the spectrum to get to litigation?
The only time that happens is in courted mediation. So for example, in many districts, and I'm sure it's like in Canada as well, particularly in family law, probably more common in family law than anything else, is where the judge will order mediation. And not only that, it's oftentimes ordered within the court system whereby they've got mediators that are not terribly well-trained or qualified. and they'll spend 2 or 3 hours with the parties to try to mediate a solution. But even if it's not, if they come because the judge has ordered it, sometimes there's a danger that a pro forma to move beyond to litigation. So you've got to be a little careful of that. And if that is the case, if it's a court-ordered mediation, you suspect that's what it is, you're better off spending time in that mediation educating the parties about what it looks like moving towards the right and what the options are of resolution, rather than trying to go straight into the mediation process.
I'm going to paint a picture for you, and I'd like to see how you would respond. Now, this is a specific example, and you could tell me that this doesn't necessarily make sense if it doesn't make sense for you. Let's say, for example, you get to a point where the only option is to go to litigation. Both parties are fighting. You can't find a way for people to agree with each other. You've gone from negotiation to mediation, maybe even explored arbitration, but they've just decided, screw it, we're going to go straight to litigation. Do you have like a Hail Mary that you throw at the end to try and stop that from happening? Or do you just say, all right, I've done what I have to do. And, you know, what's the way that you sleep well at night knowing that you've done everything that you can do before they try and destroy each other in court?
Well, two responses to that. The first response is that in order to resolve a dispute, it has to be ripe for resolution, as I call it. And sometimes it's not ripe for resolution. It's again, like international affairs, where sometimes there have to be a few shots fired across the border until both parties realize what we're getting ourselves into. That's the one aspect. So you've got to ask yourself, is this dispute actually ripe for resolution? And it may not be. They may have to go through some volleys of litigation before it actually becomes ripe for resolution. The second point that I want to make is when a person says, I want to litigate this, in using our negotiation jargon, if you will, essentially that's a position. That's, again, a rigid position. I'm going to litigate. And we can treat that as a position and try to find the interests. Why would you litigate? For what purpose would you litigate? And what would be your underlying interest in litigating as opposed to finding some cheaper and more effective means of resolution? And sort of walking them down that path of trying to understand what those interests and trying to loosen, again, those deep roots of that big oak tree.
Yeah.
But again, never imposing, never say, you know, if they decide that's what it is, you know, you've got to be able to walk away. Try to, you know, help them to sort of see what that looks like and try to understand what some of the interests are, to try to find other solutions. And, you know, they might say, well, I'm just afraid that I'll agree to something I might regret. So at that point, I'll say, well, how about we try to mediate and look at some various options without any commitment? You know, then I'll try to find solutions to the interests as opposed to responding to the position.
This is my interpretation. I find the mediation process to be a lot more collaborative than the litigation process, at least on the surface from an outsider looking in. I was chatting with a litigator once who was the chief litigator of a firm, which I won't name, but that person was seen as like the chief attack dog of that organization. And their job was solely to seek and destroy and like go in and destroy as much as humanly possible of the other party. It wasn't collaborative. There was no sort of way to find common interests. It was attack all the time. And that person was built for that role, right? And there are certain litigators that are just designed purely for that role. And we need those people. I'm not saying that we don't need those people, but it seemed like such a acidic process and such a vindictive process that on the surface, it was just like, whoa, this is crazy. This guy, all he thought about was attack. It didn't seem collaborative whatsoever. Am I wrong there?
No, you're absolutely right. And as you mentioned correctly, sometimes we need that. The problem is in corporations where they have in-house counsel, that's all they have. And the way I look at it is you need both the Department of Defense, which is what that is, and you need a Department of State, which deals with the diplomacy side. And they need to balance one another out. The problem is in many situations, such as that corporation and many corporations like that, have the Department of Defense, but they don't have the Department of State. And I think corporations would be well served to have both those departments, in-house legal teams, both the Department of Defense and the Department of State, and use them as necessary. Imagine the United States. Well, it's hard to imagine the United States anyway. Imagine the United States with a Department of Defense only and no Department of State.
Yeah, and no diplomacy.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. I like the way that you tie that to essentially it would be like a large organization is much like a government. To a large extent, and having those departments are key. Whether or not they're individual people is another thing entirely.
Right. In fact, a large corporation would be even well advised to actually have a completely separate Department of State with a VP of negotiation and dispute resolution and so on.
I've seen a lot of chatter about this recently where people are arguing for sort of like the chief negotiation officer role within an organization to keep that diplomacy going.
Correct. I think that's something we may be worth looking at for larger corporations.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Well, as always, my friend, this has been a fascinating discussion. I sincerely appreciate you coming on, but I'm sure that there are going to be a lot of people that want to follow you and follow your stuff online. How do they do that?
Okay, well, so my website is my name, lapinnegotiationservices.com. So that's easy enough. I've just recently, very proudly, just started a YouTube channel.
Oh, good.
And that's under my regular name, Raphael Lapin, R-A-P-H-A-E-L, and last name L-A-P, as in Peter, I-N, as in Nancy. So I would love for people to subscribe to that. We're going to be putting out some video stuff, a few videos up there already. And again, always I try to make sure that there's information that's relevant and practical for people to use. So, you know, that certainly is good. And people should feel free. You know, I'm always available for reaching out. And you know, I love hearing from people. So I would love to connect with anybody who would see fit to connect with me.
Awesome. For the listeners, just so that you know, we will link out to the YouTube channel. We will also link out to Raphael's website, as well as his social profiles in our show notes. Just go to the website for that and look at this episode. Raphael, thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Certainly, Mark, sure.
Hey, friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.